Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today, 941-877-1552, or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1, my new book, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know. Available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. Long considered the wild man of Lynyrd Skynyrd, Artemus Pyle's powerful and distinctive double bass drumming helped define the legendary Skynyrd sound. Artemus got his first real break at the Charlie Daniels Band's Volunteer Jam. His first recording list, Artemus Pyle's percussion. Then with other work for the Marshall Tucker Band, Artemus became known as a powerful session drummer. Using his connections with Charlie Daniels and Marshall Tucker, both acts that toured often with Skynyrd, Artemus met Ronnie Van Sant and Ed King at Studio One in Doraville, Georgia. The results of that meeting, Saturday Night Special, greatly impressed Ronnie. Artemus' live debut with the band took place in Jacksonville, Sgt. Pepper's Club, in October of 1974. The gig, a show to raise money and awareness for Jacksonville's food bank, was hot. Everyone remembers the band walking through the front door and into a crush of people that doubled the legal occupancy of the club. Playing under the hot lights in an overpacked club with an underpowered air conditioner made for a memorable night when Bob Burns left the band permanently following Skynyrd's first European tour in December of 74. Artemus quickly got the nod as Skynyrd's new drummer. The years Artemus played with Skynyrd were the years that solidified the legend behind the band, quickly developing into one of the nation's top touring draws with a grueling schedule of 300 shows a year. The constant work and touring paid off. By October 20th, 77, Skynyrd songs had become radio staples. More than just a tribute to Lynyrd Skynyrd, a tribute to the man that defined it, Artemus Pyle now has said, "If it wasn't for Ronnie, no one would know my name." Since his departure from Skynyrd in 1991, Artemus Pyle's career had led him down an amazing path of solo records and projects, culminating in one of the finest tributes to Southern rock royalty. The Artemus Pyle Band is a high-energy, true-to-the-music and true-to-the-era rock group, one of the few that is on the road today. Artemus Pyle, Brad Durden, Jerry Lida, Dan Fowler, and Scott Raines are not only a group of friends and contemporaries, but a group of some of the most seasoned musicians in the Southeast. Artemus Power Band delivers hit after hit after hit, night after night after night. From Freebird to Sweet Home Alabama, APB gives fans the best of Skynyrd with one of men who made it. Please welcome legendary drummer, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and with classic rock legends Lynyrd Skynyrd, Artemus Pyle, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Artemus.
Hey, Ray.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing good. We're in Florida here, and the virus came back, which sucks.
Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, exactly. I met you. I was working at the Capitol Center in Maryland, and Skynyrd was there rehearsing. And it was me and three other guys, and we sat there and we watched you guys rehearse your new song, Saturday Night Special. And I remember you there, and we actually all passed a joint around that day as well. But I got a great show, just me and three other guys watching you guys rehearse. It was pretty cool.
I'm sure we did pass around a joint.
I bumped into Ronnie backstage too, accidentally.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you got to have a brush with greatness, as David Letterman used to say.
Yep. You know, I had Ed King on the show before he passed away, and I also interviewed Al Cooper. I also had your buddy Jimmy Hall on recently, but Ed King told me that you're a hero, you know, for doing what you did in that airplane.
Well, Ed heard the stories. He wasn't there, of course.
Right.
And I miss Ed, and Jimmy Hall is a great person, mm-hmm. I think he can, as far as Southern rock singers, I think he can be considered the greatest voice of Southern rock at this time. I just saw Wet Willie play on the Rock Legends cruise last year, just before the pandemic hit.
Right.
And Jimmy Hall has an incredible voice, incredible range, incredible quality, and I think he's the best. So I miss Ed, and I love Jimmy, and you know, it's a good day for all the people that worked hard on our movie, because I understand that we're trending number one on Amazon.
Oh, awesome.
I understand that Amazon has sold out of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they'll get restocked.
Right.
And all the reviews have been favorable. The review from Variety, I felt it was a very fair assessment of the movie.
Yeah, you must be proud of that. And also, the you didn't know that they were going to focus the whole movie on you, did they? Did you?
Well, have you seen it?
I've seen parts of it. I saw the trailer. I haven't seen the whole movie yet.
Well, the reason that it was ended up being focused on my story is, you know, with all of the legal lawsuit that was coming at us, Judy Van Zandt, Ronnie's widow,
right,
and her army of blood-sucking weasel attorneys kept coming at us the entire time we were trying to make the film.
Right.
And I went to Vector Management in Nashville and asked them, you know, to go to Judy and Terry and ask them to come to the table and let's make a bigger film and all together and something we could all be proud of. And but instead, they chose to try to diminish my role in the band, as they always do.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to steal from me, as they always do. And I didn't do the movie to make money.
Right.
I did not ask for one dime from the making of the movie. I only wanted to tell the story. And I asked Gary and Judy to come to the table. But instead, they went to New York City and got a bunch of attorneys that are basically criminals, and came after Cleopatra Films and myself, calling us every name in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But they lost. It went to the Court of Appeals, three judges, which is our constitution.
Right.
And Ray, do you remember when we had a constitution in America?
Yeah, I think I do remember that. Most people don't.
Yeah, it's called Constitution. And three judges rule against Judy.
Right.
And her judge that she had in her pocket, he was 96 years old. His name was Judge Robert Sweet.
Right.
Pretty sharp old bird, really. But Judy had him bought off, and he ruled in her favor, and the Court of Appeals ruled against her. And so we were able to finish the movie in spite of, you know, her attacks.
And you had written a book. What year did you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book over the past 5 years.
Right.
It has not been published. It's, you know, 25 chapters, 380 pages, 120,000 words.
Right.
With references. It's a real book. It's called Street Survivor.
Right.
And that's me. But it has not been published because, again, Judy sent her blood-sucking weasel attorneys after my publishing company, which was Backbeat Publications.
Sure.
Out of New York City.
Yeah, I know them.
And after Judy threatened them with nasty letters, you know, lawyers live to write horrible, nasty letters. They would sue their own mothers.
Right.
And they sent letters to Backbeat, John Cirillo, and they folded like a lawn chair and brought me it doesn't matter to me. I had worked with them. I gave them a book under budget and on time, a good book, but they dropped me immediately because of Judy's threats. And I was very surprised that they folded the way they did after Judy had lost the lawsuit about the movie.
Right.
So my book is done, and I will publish it one day, but Ray, you know, in my world, I can only get behind a major project one at a time.
Right.
And we wanted to roll the movie out, and once we accept the movie out, which is being done right now, as we speak, I will then publish my book, self-published, or I have a few people that have volunteered to publish it. So it will happen, but just one big project at a time, you know what I'm saying?
Sure, sure. Artemis, you're kind of breaking up a little bit. Are you in a place where that might be happening?
I live out in the country.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe you're in between rooms or something like that. I don't know. But
can you hear me now?
Yeah, I hear you much better now. I hear you much better.
Okay.
You know
what couldn't you hear?
I did get it all, but it was going in and out. So, but I heard the last few sentences that you did that you mentioned. But
I was just saying that my book will be published.
Okay.
In spite of the fact that Judy and her horrible attorneys threatened everybody in my publishing company, and they dropped me like a hot potato. But, you know, I will publish it. I was just saying to you, I'm a drummer and a rock band, and my capabilities are one big project at a time.
Right.
So we're rolling out the movie, and then we'll do my book.
You know, on Amazon, your book is showing. It says out of print, limited availability. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but somebody told me that about a year ago.
Yeah.
And the reason is because the book was going to be published, and
right.
Then Backbeat Publications and John Cirillo
mm-hmm.
dropped me like a hot potato.
Okay.
Because of the threats from Judy Van Zandt.
Right.
So a lot of people thought, you know, the book was finished, and it was finished.
Yep.
And a lot of people thought we were going to release it. But, you know, it's just a small bump in the road.
Yeah, you'll get it done. I know that for sure. You're a hero. Basically, you saved a lot of people that day, didn't you? But I don't know how anybody could have gotten out of that airplane.
I did get out, and I did go for help, and that's what the movie, when you see it, that's what the movie will portray. But I never called myself a hero.
Right.
Gary Rossington, for years, called me his hero, and stated the facts, which is that I, you know, had severe injuries. I got out of the wreckage of the plane, tried to help as many people as I could with my Marine Corps training.
Exactly.
And then realized that I needed to go get help. And that's exactly what I did. But Gary was trotted out by his management company, Vector Management, out of Nashville. I had said some things about Gary and his wife and Judy Van Zandt and their greed and their unethical business practices. And so they felt that they needed to say something nasty about me. So Gary came out on VH1 with Jake Tapper.
Right.
When Jake was working for VH1 and said that I ran away from the plane crash because I was scared.
Oh my God.
After, you know, after years of Gary saying that I was his hero. That was his words, not mine.
Yeah.
And, so they came out and they said that I ran away, and I told Jake Tapper at the time, I said, number one, I couldn't run because I had injuries. And number two, you damn right I was scared because I saw my friends killed in front of my eyes.
Right.
And I found the pilot and co-pilot, and they were torn up and both definitely dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, you know, that we needed help, and I went for it and brought help back to the crash site. So, you know, in response to Gary, I don't care what my frame of mind was when I left the crash site, as long as I came back, which I did,
right,
with help. And I told Jake Tapper, you're damn right I was scared.
Well, you even went to a farmer, right? And you knocked on his door, and the guy, I guess, kind of freaked out because he saw the condition you were in. And at first, right?
I didn't knock on his door. I was walking up in his barnyard.
Uh-huh.
And he came out with a gun.
Yep.
And pointed it at me. And I was going into shock from the plane crash.
Right.
I was in severe shock. I heard a gunshot after seeing the gun. And I felt something sting. And I felt that I was shot, and something stung me in my left shoulder, and I yelled, plane crash, and the farmer, Johnny Moat, stated, oh my God, I'm so sorry. He says he didn't shoot me.
Right.
He says it was a ricochet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my response to that is, I don't give a damn what it was. I heard a gunshot. I was in shock. I thought I was shot. I felt something sing. And if it was a ricochet, you know, so what?
Right, right. Artemis, in my mind, you are a hero, man. And I want to tell you, thank you for your service in the Marine Corps. I want to say to you, thanks for your father in World War II. Also, I read about your dad. I'm taking care of my dad. He's 95 years old, and he's a World War II Marine Corps guy as well. So, Semper Fi, man.
Semper Fi, and you tell your father that I said thank you.
I sure will.
You know, he could have fought right alongside my father.
Probably. Yeah, he was in Saipan, and he was in Okinawa. I don't know if your dad was in Germany or in Japan.
Dad was in Japan.
He was in Japan. How about that?
South Pacific, yes, sir.
Yeah, same thing. So was my dad. Yeah. And my father-in-law was in Germany. He was a point man, you know. He walked right next to the tanks as well. So, man, I you know, I give you guys a lot of credit. My brother was in Vietnam, you know. You guys are the true heroes. You really are.
Well, I had orders for Vietnam, and then my father was killed in a mid-air plane collision in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Yep.
And my orders were canceled, and of course we pulled out of Vietnam, so I never had to see that. but I do everything I can for band and I, as you mentioned, Jeremy Lyda, Brad Burden, Scott Raines, and David Fowler, and myself, we are APB, and we play Lynyrd Skynyrd music better than any band in the world.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Or none.
Definitely.
And, you know, I do want to say that the making of this film, Cleopatra Films, could have pulled out at any time, but they hung in there against all odds. And I can't say enough about Brian Pereira and Tim Yasui and the crew at Cleopatra Films in Los Angeles and all of the young men and women that portrayed us in the movie. They put their hearts and souls into these portrayals. And, you know, they were very happy to be about a movie about something that really happened. And, so I can't say enough about the crew from Cleopatra and all of the, you know, the young actors and actresses that portrayed us in our 20s. And, you know, we did the best that we possibly could with the small budget that we had.
Exactly.
And the fact that Judy and her criminal cohorts, you know, were coming at us the entire time, trying to make as much trouble as they could, when they could have come to the table with me and made a film together. That's what I wanted. But, you know, the film ended up, because of all the legal stuff, I had to, and Cleopatra had to step back and make the movie basically my story. And I wanted it to be bigger, but I am very proud of the effort that we made. And, you know, I'm not making excuses because we had a bad time of it or the fact that we had a small budget. But Judy spent $2 million on a bunch of weasel attorneys.
That's a shame.
And, you know, that money would have gone a long way on our budget.
Yep.
And we could have made a more broader spectrum of a film.
I agree.
And, you know, Gary could have been a part of it. There's only Gary Rossington and myself left.
Right.
You know, from the original band and people on the airplane. So I love Gary. I miss Gary. We played for the kings and queens of rock and roll all over the world. And, but they keep us separated because they know that if Gary and I got together, there'd be a lot less money for them to steal.
Yeah.
So, you know, Gary's had 6 heart attacks in 6 years.
Wow.
And, the only silver lining of the COVID-19 virus is that Gary could go home and actually get some rest.
Yeah.
Without being shamed to go back on the road and make that money for, you know, a bunch of people that had nothing to do with Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is what it is. I accept it. I, you know, God grant me the strength to, accept the things that I can't change. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Well, there's still a lot of positivity. You did get it. The movie's out. Your book will be published. So, you know, it sounds like, you know, you had a hard time with it, but things are finally maybe going your way a little bit. So, you know.
And Ray, I appreciate that, man, as far as talking about, you know, staying positive.
Right.
I wanted to stay positive through all of this, but Judy and her attorneys and Gary and his wife, and all of them that are so greedy, you know, just wouldn't, you know, open their eyes and, come to the table.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's their loss, but, you know, I love Gary. I miss Gary.
Right.
I'd love to see Gary. But that won't happen.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, he is surrounded by some very sinister people.
Right. Unfortunately, this happens with rock bands all the time. I mean, I talk to so many people that are feuding, and attorneys are involved, and it's a shame. But you know, it's like a family.
The attorneys are the only ones that win.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
They love the feud because they get to go to the bank.
They're going to get their money anyway.
But, you know, it is a way of life. And, you know, you were talking about you've heard these stories before in rock bands. And it all comes down to, I think, the one word, I think, is greed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm 72 years old this July.
Right.
And I have 8 incredible children and grandchildren.
God bless you.
They all play drums.
Yeah, cool.
They're all musically inclined. And, you know, we just try to remain positive. You know, my son Chris wrote 3 songs for the movie soundtrack.
Oh, really?
My son Marshall wrote a prominently placed, beautiful song that's in the movie soundtrack.
Awesome.
And, of course, my band... the guys that you mentioned that I was talking about, we wrote a song called Street Survivor, which is the title track for the movie. And I think the soundtrack for this original movie about something that really happened, I feel that it's a Grammy award-winning category. You know, my band wrote the song Street Survivor with Warren Haynes.
Love Warren.
Scott Raines.
Warren's a great guy.
Together with Warren Haynes.
Yep.
And then our entire band arranged it and recorded it. And I'll tell you something, Ray, when you hear it, you got my telephone number. You call me back and let me know what you think.
Okay.
I think it's one of the very first Southern rock hits that's been out there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that we'll get a lot of airplay with Street Survivor because, you know, it is a tremendously crafted Southern rock song, man, that is just as natural as falling off a log. And I love playing it. I channel John Bonham when I play it, man.
Well, I'm going to promote the hell out of it.
Please do. And listen to it. And just crank it up.
I will.
And tell me what you think. I think it's one of the bona fide Southern rock hits.
Right.
And there's not been one for a long time.
Yep. You should get together and do some stuff with Jimmy, you know?
Oh, man, I've recorded with Jimmy, and Jimmy and I have played together many times in different bands. I love Jimmy and his entire family. Donna Hall, I don't know anybody that wasn't in love with Donna Hall back in the 70s. You know, she was a backup singer for Wet Willie.
Right, right.
And she still is beautiful and still sings her butt off. And then, of course, his brother, Jack Hall, that plays bass. And Jack has had some medical issues as of late, but he still performs with the band, and and his son also sits in on bass for live show. I saw them on the Rock Legends Cruise out of Fort Lauderdale for the Native American Heritage Association we did last year, just before the coronavirus hit, and I watched their entire set, and man, I gotta tell you, they still have TK Lively on drums.
Yep.
I love him. We're friends for a long time, and their band sounds better than ever, and Jimmy's singing better than ever. I mean, you know, it says a lot that a guy like Jeff Beck, you know,
that's right,
one of the greatest guitar player of all time, you know, insists on having Jimmy Hall do his vocals for him. So, you know, says a lot.
Yeah, he's a good guy too. You know, we had a great conversation together, and I love Jimmy. He's awesome.
I love him, man.
We got a few things in common. I got married in Kentucky. You're from Louisville, originally, right?
I was born in Louisville, Kentucky. That's right.
Yep. My father-in-law went to Louisville. As a matter of fact, my wife's uncle, he's a Van Sant.
Wow.
And he played football in Louisville, and I got married in Henderson. You know where that is?
Yeah.
Yep, near Evansville. That's where I got married. So I married a Kentucky girl.
Well, a man from Kentucky is sure lucky.
Great place. I spent my first day of my honeymoon in Louisville, and then we flew to Hawaii from there. But
that sounds like a plan there.
That was a good plan. That was a good plan. I got to ask you about the plane itself. Aerosmith was supposed to fly in that plane as well, right? Is that true?
That is true. That is depicted in the movie.
Right.
And they turned it down. And, you know, just before our crash, Ronnie and I and the entire band decided to buy two more tour buses for the girls
right.
and for our crew, and we were going to buy a Learjet for the band.
Right.
And just us, and that would cut our flight time from 2.5 hours to 45 minutes or under. And, you know, we were moving our whole operation from New York City to Jacksonville with, rehearsal studios, a recording studio, apartments, for anybody that lived out of state like me.
Right.
And, you know, we had planned on doing that because we had, Ronnie found out that Peter Rudge, our manager, who eventually turned his back on all of us,
mm-hmm.
and left us for dead, and he's depicted in the movie, that Rudge was basically a crook.
Right.
And so Ronnie was going to move the whole operation from New York City because he said it, I remember him saying, if you send $1 million from, you know, ticket sales to New York City, the check you get in Florida is going to be a lot less, you know, and he was concerned that Rudge was stealing from us, which we all felt like he was.
Yeah.
And, you know, after the crash, Rudge went back under a rock where he belongs.
Yeah. That's a shame. That's a shame. But that's another story in rock and roll history. Managers, you know, and managers and, you know, promoters and screwing the band, you know, and I mean, there's so many damn stories out there. It's ridiculous.
He made a bunch of money on his life insurance policy that he had on Ronnie. I understood that he had a key man life insurance policy.
Really?
And after Ronnie was killed, Rudge bought a soccer team. I could be wrong on that, but I'm not wrong about the nature of his personality.
Mm-hmm.
He's a snake.
Yeah.
But you know, he made a lot of money on us, and we were, you know, splattered against the planet Earth, and I specifically asked him for some help for all of our crew and band members that were, like, in, you know, 10 different hospitals all over the country, and he flatly turned me down and said there was nothing he could do, whereas the day before the plane crash, he and Mike Maitland from MCA Records
mm-hmm.
were in our dressing room talking about how we were their favorite people.
Right.
And basically just smoothing everybody's ass. And then when I asked them for help, they said their hands were tied and there was nothing they could do.
Yeah.
I was unbelievably disappointed.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, you know, punch both of them in the mouth. but, you know, they, I guess they have to live with the fact that they have flawed characters, and that's not my problem.
Yeah. The plane, was it out of fuel? Is that what the main problem, what happened there?
Yes, we were just about bone dry.
Oh, my gosh.
We took on 400 gallons of fuel in Greenville, South Carolina, just before the last flight, but they didn't check the fuel gauges.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a pilot. You know, all my friends were killed in plane crashes.
Yeah.
My father was killed in a plane crash.
Yeah.
I've been in 3 airplane crashes.
Oh, my goodness.
So I figured I was qualified to tell the story. And we didn't take on enough fuel. We didn't top off the tanks. And we were 60 miles short of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, our destination. And the pilots made, you know, unrecoverable errors. and they paid for it with their lives.
Yeah, I took flying lessons. I almost got my ticket, but then too many people were crashing that I knew. Same thing happened to me. But, you know, I did all those maneuvers, you know, in open fields and things, you know, that when you run out of gas, was there no open field around? Was it all trees? Is that what happened? Or
there was an open field in front of us.
Right.
But the co-pilot salvoed the fuel, the little fuel that we had left.
Uh-huh.
He dumped it. And had he not dumped it, we might have had one engine pulling us along far enough to get over the trees that we crashed in there in Mississippi and into an open field.
Right.
Where, with the landing gear up, a belly landing would have been the best scenario.
Right. At least you would have had a chance.
We could have skidded in.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, you got more of a chance in a propeller than you do in a jet, for sure, you know.
That is true.
Yeah. I had some close calls, too. I was in the Cessna, you know, 170, 175, and we almost hit some birds, and a crosswind hit us, and we almost toppled on the runway. But, you know, my son-in-law, his grandfather was in the military, and he died in a plane crash. He died, it hit a mountain. So that's kind of strange. Kind of a coincidence there, too.
You know, there's a lot of mistakes made by a
yes.
lot of pilots. And,
it's a shame.
You know, but it's not always pilot error.
Right. Mechanical.
You know, there's a lot of great pilots that have, I mean, look at, you know, Sully.
Right, Sully. Yep.
The Miracle on the Hudson. I mean, that's the guy you want.
Exactly.
That's what you want your pilot to look like.
Exactly. I did not know you played with the Atlanta Rhythm Section on Champagne Jam. I did not know that.
I did a little bit of percussion and stuff.
Yeah, but you were on. You played on Imaginary Lover.
I didn't play drums on that. That was Robert Nix.
Oh, okay. But you were on the album. I saw your name on the credits. On Champagne Jam.
I played some percussion.
Right, right.
I love that band.
Great
band.
It was
one of Ronnie Van Zant's favorite bands.
Great band. I loved them too. Yeah.
And their music is amazing. You know, Ronnie Hammond, the lead singer.
Right.
You know, Robert Nix, the drummer.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, hung out with the Beatles. He played with Ron Orbison. You can't get any better than that.
No, you can't.
And I spoke at Robert Nix's funeral.
Yeah.
And I loved him. We were jamming together in a band called Deep South, playing double drums. And he's, you know, Robert was meat and potatoes, and I'm kind of a sober type drummer. So the two of us worked really well together. He had an amazing technique, and I have no technique, so we were perfect.
Ronnie Van Zant said something about you. He said that they used to keep you in a cage and feed them raw meat, and they only let you out when it's time to play.
Yeah, that was hilarious, considering I'm a vegetarian.
So, were you the Keith Moon of the band?
No, the Keith Moon of our band was Leon Wilkinson.
Okay. But
they called me the wild man because I guess because I look like a wild man. But you know, Leon was the artful dodger.
Uh huh.
He was the merry prankster.
The merry prankster. Okay, here I was going to ask you this other question, but you have a style for taping your drumsticks, right? They call it a gladiator grip.
Yeah, I used to do that. Now, rather than do all that to each stick, I wear Zilke black leather gloves. They're ultra light.
Right.
And I put a little water on them before I start the set, and the moisture on the leather and the wood. It it bonds. It makes a bond, and so I don't have to, like, grip the stick so hard. I can let them, you know, kind of loose in my hands, and it just gives me the ability to slam a little bit harder.
Right, right. Yeah, I've seen you wearing those gloves.
And that's what I do these days, yeah.
Yeah. All right, here's a topic that I got to bring up, because you would know more about it than anybody. Being a Marine, being from the South, what do you think about the Confederate flag controversy going on?
What about it?
Well, do you think they're going overboard with this thing? And I mean, it's part of our history, right?
Yes, unfortunately it is. But it symbolizes, no matter what everybody says about heritage,
right?
The fact is that it symbolizes, you know, hatred and slavery. I will state right now for you unequivocally that I am in favor 100% of the Black Lives Matter.
Okay.
I support that 100%. These people have every reason to be upset, and I support them 100%. I am, in my band, I'm known as the left-wing liberal.
Okay.
And, you know, I really believe that this country, the racism, is unbelievable, and it needs to stop. And if the Confederate flag, I used to sit in front of the largest Confederate flag ever made. You know, we had one made for like $25,000, and my drums sat right in front of it.
Huh.
And, but now, you know, and Gary Rossington and I agree on this.
Mm-hmm.
I heard, Gary in an interview, that, you know, that was then and this is now.
Right.
And if it's offensive, if it's offensive and brings up, pain to any American citizen, then it should be taken down. And a lot of the Confederate statues were put up just as a big middle finger, you know, to the North,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to Black people.
Right.
So, you know, I understand why they don't want to have that in their face. It is a part of history, so all that stuff should be put into a big museum.
Right.
You know, where people can come and look at it. You know.
I asked the question because, you know, bands like Skynyrd and, you know, Black Oak Arkansas, you know, a lot of the Southern bands always had that symbol, you know, the flag out there for shows.
Yeah, but that was for us.
Right.
For us, that was MCA Records.
Right.
Trying to sell records, you know, of a Southern rock band. So they paired us with the Confederate flag because, you know, MCA Records, all they care about is money.
Right.
Bottom line. So that was a lot of their push as well. And besides, the guys in the band, they looked at the Confederate flag. To them, it just meant they were from the South.
Right, right.
And they were proud of that.
Yep.
But, you know, as Gary stated, when you go further and look into it, and it's not just representing the South, it's representing slavery and, you know, bad treatment for, you know, American citizens. And we live on this planet Earth, man. We're all human beings.
Yep.
I love Black people.
Mm-hmm.
I love Chinese people. I love gay people. I love anybody from this planet that is a good person, and that's the way Ronnie Van Zant was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't judge people. If you were a good person,
right,
then you were a good person, period. It didn't matter
right.
What color your skin was, and that's the way Ronnie felt. I mean, look at the song, The Ballad of Curtis Lowe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Talked about a Black man with white curly hair that is the greatest guitar picker the world has ever seen.
Yep.
Why would Ronnie say that?
Yep.
Why would he wear t-shirts with Jimi Hendrix on it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen Ronnie interact with African Americans, you know, on the road,
mm-hmm.
and he loves all people, and that's the way I am.
Yep. No, I agree with you. You know, if you got a good heart, you know, doesn't matter who you are, you know,
And, that's exactly right.
Yep.
Well, look, man, you've got my telephone number.
I do.
So please call me after you see the movie and tell me what you think.
I will. Artemis, here's the last question, if you have time.
Yes, sir.
If you had a Field of Dreams, I ask everybody this question. If you had a Field of Dreams like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
You mean musically collaborate?
Collaborate, play drums in a band, for anything like that.
Well, I mean, it would be a wonderful thing to play some drums with Bob Dylan.
With Bob Dylan, okay.
You know, that would be an honor for any drummer.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many great artists that are out there. I particularly love Prince.
Right.
Because I'm a fire drummer.
Right.
You know, I would have loved to have been able to jam, with Prince or Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix, yeah.
You know, but if you're talking about living people, you know, I would love to play drums on a track with Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, anybody of that stature, I would be honored to do what I do, and that's take little wooden sticks and bang on little round things.
I like the way you put that. Artemis, you're a great drummer, man. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it. I'm going to let you know what I think about the movie. I love the trailer, but I want to hear all the music in it. Like, you know, I want to hear your kids in it, and I want to get a full critique of the whole movie. And I'm looking forward to it. Now I got something to look forward to here.
And Street Survivor, the title track that we put, you know, that we recorded
right.
for the movie.
Yep.
That goes over the credits at the end of the movie, so
okay.
check out that song. The credits end and the song kind of fades out. There
right.
is an ending. So we're putting out a vinyl LP
oh, good.
With the soundtrack, all the songs played in their entirety.
Awesome.
Because you realize in a movie, they can't play the whole song.
Right.
So pieces are used for little scenes, and so we're putting out an LP, and there'll be a CD with mm-hmm. the DVD.
Great.
Bonus tracks, bonus features, behind the scenes, the making of the movie. So listen to Street Survivor, and tell me that, you know, if you feel like I feel, which is it's a bona fide Southern rock hit, it
okay.
should get airplay. So check it out and call me back, Ray.
I sure will. And Artemis, the band is scheduled to play at the Central Park Performing Arts Center in Largo, Florida, which is only about 45 minutes from my home here. That's September 11th at 8 p.m. I'm hoping it does not get canceled. We still got a long time yet, so maybe I'll see you there.
Hey, we'll roll out the red carpet for you, Ray. Come over, right?
Thanks, man.
I'm proud of my band.
Yep.
You will see, you know, and hear that we played the music with honor, respect, and accuracy.
Well, I appreciate all
and
you
I,
do,
you know,
man.
And I'm having more fun playing drums now than
good.
I ever have in my life.
That's what it's all about. Thanks, Artemis. Thank you so much, man. God bless you.
Thank you, Ray. Looking forward to meeting you.
Me too, man. Take care.
See you in a minute.
All righty. Bye-bye now. Street Survivors, the true story of the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash, is available on DVD at Amazon.com. 1977, the plane carrying Southern rock legends Lynyrd Skynyrd mysteriously runs out of gas midair en route to a concert, crashing into a dangerous Mississippi swamp while killing several of the band members, crew, and both pilots. Street Survivors, the true story of the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash, tells the story through one of the survivors, drummer Artemis Pyle, who not only survived the fatal crash that claimed the life of the band's founder and frontman, Ronnie Van Sant, amongst others, but who also bravely pulled the remaining survivors out of the plane wreckage before staggering towards the nearest farmhouse in rural Mississippi to seek help. And he's got Street Survivor Keeping the Beat in Lynyrd Skynyrd. That's a hardcover book. Should be available also on Amazon very soon. That's a book by Artemis Pyle and Dean Goodman. For more information about Artemis Pyle and the Artemis Pyle Band, visit www.artemispyleband.com, the official website. Go to the Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Artemis Pyle Band. Go to the Leonard Skinner History website at www.leonardskinnerhistory.com. And the Artemis Pyle Band is scheduled to perform Friday, September 11th at 8 o'clock at Central Park Performing Arts Center in Largo, Florida. For tickets, visit www.largoarts.com. Very special thanks to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with Artemis Pyle and the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news. My new book, finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1. It chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us all free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook at bookbaby.com. Hardcover is a collector's edition featuring over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. 5 stars by Literary Titan. And it is a Gold Star Gold Award winner. Have a great week, everybody. Stay safe and healthy. God bless.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.